Shrimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 47, entitled The Song of the Bee. And we're going to be reading from four verses, starting with text 7. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Nisvam tyajantikanika. Akalpam nipatim prajaha. Adita vidya acharyam. Ritvijo datta dakshinam. Nisvam tyajanti ganika. Akalpam nripatim prajaha. Aditya vidya acharyam. Ritvijo datta dakshinam. Please chant. Nisvam, one without any assets. Tyajanti, abandon. Ganika, prostitute. Akalpam, incompetent. Nuipratim, a king. Praja, citizen. Aditya Vidya, those who have completed their education. Acharyam, the teacher. Ritvijaya, priest. Datta, the sacrificer who has given. Dakshinam, their remuneration. Translation. Prostitutes abandon a penniless man, subjects an incompetent king. students, their teacher, once they have finished their education, and priests, a man who has remunerated them for a sacrifice. And we're reading three more verses. She can need to kind of relate something. Tyaga vita phalam riksham bhukta chati tayo griham dagdam rikas tatanya yam jara bhukta vratam shriyam. Birds abandon a tree when its fruits are gone, guests a house after they have eaten, animals a forest that has burned down, and a lover the woman he has enjoyed, even though she remains attached to him. Iti gopyo hi gopinde gatavakaya manasaha krishna dute samayate udave tyakta lokika kayantya priya karmani rudantyas chakatarhya tasya samsmitya samsmitya yani kaishora balayo. Thus speaking, the gopis, whose words, bodies, and minds were fully dedicated to Lord Govinda, put aside all their regular work now that Krishna's messenger, Sri Uddhava, had arrived among them. Constantly remembering the activities their beloved Krishna had performed in his childhood and youth, they sang about them and cried without shame. Purport. The word balyayaho here indicates that ever since their childhood, the gopis had been completely in love with Krishna. Thus, even though social custom dictated that they not reveal their love to others, they forgot all external considerations and wept openly before Krishna's messenger, Uddhava. I'll read the text in order. Prostitutes abandon a penniless man, subjects an incompetent king, students their teacher once they have finished their education, and priests, a man who has remunerated them for a sacrifice. Birds abandon a tree when its fruits are gone, guests a house after they have eaten, animals a forest that has burned down, and a lover the woman he has enjoyed, even though she remains attached to him. Thus speaking, the gopis, whose words, bodies, and minds were fully dedicated to Lord Govinda, put aside all the regular work now that Krishna's messenger, Sri Uddhava, had arrived among them. Constantly remembering the activities their beloved Krishna had performed in his childhood and youth, they sang about them and cried without shame. These verses are the gopis speaking to Uddhava, and at first it seems that these examples that they're giving seem valid, but then in the Krishna book, when Prabhupada translates these verses, he says this at the end of that list of examples that gopis gave. Prabhupada wrote, "In this way, all the gopis indirectly accused Krishna by citing many examples." So when I read that, I just suddenly saw all those examples in a different light. Like at first, when I read them, they seem valid. They seem like they're describing valid situations of abandonment. But then, in the light of what Prabhupada is saying, he's saying that the gopis are actually indirectly accusing Krishna. So then when I went back and read them again, they seemed a little different. And I think the biggest clue was the last one, where the gopis are saying that a person, that a man would love a woman and then just abandon her, even though she was attached. And this seems to really describe what the gopis are saying, because they are not happy that, you know, Krishna has left them and or seemingly left them. And then when you go back over the other examples, then they all have, you know, somewhat of an edge to them. But going back to the very first example, it starts with prostitutes abandon a penniless man. Well, I just wanted to address that word prostitutes, because I don't know about you, but for me, I hear that word and it has somewhat of a charge to it. And, you know, because I think I have some preconceived idea of what a prostitute is. And, you know, no, especially women don't want to be called that. You know, there's a certain connotation to the word prostitute. But when we look at the chapter, first canto, chapter 11, where the Lord is entering Dwarka, there's this wonderful description of all the different great personalities who lived in Dwarka, hearing that Krishna was arriving, and all the regular people, they went, you know, they got very excited that Krishna was coming, and this wonderful description. And then we hear this verse 19, Vara mukyascha shastaso janashta darshanotsuka lasat kundala nirbata kapola vadanashya. The translation is, at the same time, many hundreds of well-known prostitutes began to proceed on various vehicles. They were all very eager to meet the Lord, and their beautiful faces were decorated with dazzling earrings, which enhanced the beauty of their foreheads. And in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says, we may not hate even the prostitutes if they are devotees of the Lord. Even to date, there are many prostitutes in great cities of India who are sincere devotees of the Lord. By tricks of chance, one may be obliged to adopt a profession which is not very adorable in society. But that does not hamper one in executing devotional service to the Lord. Devotional service to the Lord is uncheckable in all circumstances. So that's, maybe it opens up a new view of that profession. And actually, Prabhupada goes on in that report to talk a little bit more about the necessity of that profession. So I guess it's, these things went on in the Vedic culture. Again, looking at these different examples, you know, the gopis are actually pretty. I was thinking, the examples that they gave are very creative, actually. You know, for simple village girls, it's, I would say they were thoughtful, very thoughtful in coming up with these examples. But one thing I wanted to say about the gopi, talking about the gopis, because we're reading the 10th canto, and there's very elevated, these are the most elevated devotees of Lord Krishna. And these are very intimate topics in, you know, throughout the 10th canto. And my personal reaction to talking about these topics is that it's very important to not pretend to be something we're not, or act like, well, okay, in my case, I'm not a scholar. I just admit I'm not a philosopher, I'm not a scholar. I I think I'm still around because of Srila Prabhupada's mercy, but I really can't even explain how I became a devotee or why I'm still a devotee. But I, you know, some people came because they read the books, they understand some philosophy, and they say, yes, this is for me. For myself, I just heard the chanting, and inexplicably I was attracted, and I was brought to the temple and dumped there by a friend. And because, seriously, and because back in the 1970s, devotees were very merciful, and anybody who showed up, they were just happy they were there, you know. So even though I don't think I don't know, according to Ananga Manjari, I slept for a week, and she was a little worried about me, but every time I woke up, she had put some burfi in my mouth. I don't know, you know, I think I'm here because I do see the value of serving, but beyond that, I mean, I just so appreciate the devotees' classes they give here. I can see that devotees are really understand the philosophy and really can express it very well, and it's very enlivening, but for myself, it's sort of a mystery, but anyway, in looking at this concept of pretending, you know, I was thinking, well, who in Krishna Lila do we find, you know, had a pretension? So with one, a little help from friends, I came up with a few examples. Well, the examples I came up with was Samba, but I'll get to that because that was a very clear example. But one person who really was pretending was Pondraka. Now, Pondraka was a very foolish guy. He was not only claiming that he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but he went right to Krishna and told him, "You're not the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I am." He was just completely ridiculous. So here's one of his challenges. "Since I alone am the true personality of Godhead," he said to Krishna, "you should give up your false claim to this position, as well as my divine symbols, and take shelter of me. If you do not, then prepare for battle." I mean, how foolish is that to say that to Krishna? So then Ugrasena and the members of the royal assembly, they laughed at Pondraka. And so then Lord Krishna told some messengers to bring this message to him. "Oh fool, I will force you to give up the so-called Sudarsan disc and the other divine symbols of mine you have dared to assume. And when you lie down on the battlefield, you will become the shelter of dogs." So there was Pondraka with his fake arms, so that he had the four symbols. He was dressed, you know, to look like Krishna. And what happened? They had to go to battle. I mean, it's the only way this guy was going to be subdued. So when they came out of the city and the two armies confronted each other, also Pondraka's friend, Kashi Raj, who was the king of Kashi Raj, he followed him. And described, just as the fire of universal devastation destroys every living being in all directions, so Lord Krishna annihilated the armies of Pondraka and Kashi Raj. Then, after chastising Pondraka, the Lord beheaded him and Kashi Raj with his Sudarshan disc. Thereafter, he returned to Dwarka. Because Pondraka had constantly meditated on the Supreme Lord, even dressing like him, he gained liberation. So that was very fortunate for him. But, of course, very easy lesson to understand. We don't want to become like him. There is a material example of somebody who kind of went in that direction, and that is a great famous boxer named Cassius Clay, changed his name to Muhammad Ali. And after his fights, when he would win, he would get up, put his hands up in the air and say, "I am the greatest, I am the greatest." But I have heard that He was given a Bhagavad Gita by a devotee. Bhagavatam? Are you the one who gave him Bhagavatam? It's all Prabhupada's books. So he, very fortunately, has received his books. And now in his life, he has Alzheimer's, so he's...
Parkinson's?
Oh, really? Oh, he shakes. Okay, Parkinson's? Not the greatest, no. He got his lesson. But fortunately, he has Prabhupada's books. A couple of other examples are Putana, who pretended to be a beautiful young woman and basically like Krishna's nurse. And then there was Sirpanak, who also pretended to be a beautiful, attractive personality. She was trying to get Ram's attention and wanted to marry him. But the example of Sambha was the one that I immediately had thought of. Sambha was the son of Lord Krishna and Jambavati. Lord Krishna had 16,108 wives, and with each wife, he had 10 sons and one daughter. So this was, so obviously Sambha being Krishna's son is an intimate member of Krishna's family. And it is interesting that that this particular pastime, that Lord Krishna used family members. The pastime involved Krishna's disappearance, or the disappearance of the whole Yadu dynasty. And it is entirely pastime that such an elevated personality was used. But what happened was that there was a gathering of many sages, Vishvamrita, Asita, Kanva, Durvasa, Bhrigu, Angira, Kasyapa, Vamadev, Atri, and Vashishta, along with Narada Muni. That's quite a gathering of sages. And they had done some rituals at Vasudev, Krishna's father's house. And after that, they went to a holy place named Pindaraka. And the young boys of the Yadu dynasty, they brought Sambha, who was dressed up in a woman's clothing, and they took, I read descriptions of rope or cloth. They put it underneath his sari to make him look like he was pregnant. And described how they playfully, this is all in the 11th canto, these boys playfully approached these great sages that were gathered there, and the boys grabbed hold of the sages' feet and impudently asked them with feigned humility. So feigned means fake. They said, "O learned brahmanas, this black-eyed pregnant woman has something to ask you. She is too embarrassed to inquire for herself. She is just about to give birth and is very desirous of having a son. Since all of you are great sages with infallible vision, please tell us whether her child will be a boy or a girl." So the sages saw through this feigned humility and words. They said, "Fools, she will bear you an iron club that will destroy your entire dynasty." So upon hearing the curse of the sages, the boys quickly uncovered the belly of Sambha, and indeed they observed therein was an iron club. So they were lamenting, immediately saw, their mistake and lamented that they had done this. So they didn't know what to do with this club. They took it to King Ugrasena, and he advised them to ground up the club into powder, which they were able to do, but there was one lump that wouldn't grind down. So he instructed him to throw it all into the ocean. So they did that. And one fish came along and swallowed that lump of iron. And the remaining the dust from the grinding of the club, it actually was, the waves brought it back to the shore, and it implanted it themselves there and grew into a kind of grass called iraca, which is a particular species of grass that has tall, sharp-edged blades. Now, this fish that had swallowed that lump was caught in the ocean by a fisherman in his net. And then he cut open the fish and found the lump. And then he gave it to a hunter named Jara. And that hunter fixed it to an arrowhead. And it's described in the 11th canto that Lord Krishna totally saw the significance of all these events. And although he was quite capable of reversing the Brahmana's curse, he did not wish to do so. Rather, in his form of time, he gladly sanctioned the events. So, as I said, Lord Krishna actually even accepted that his family members were involved, and there was a necessity to end his pastime, so he let things go along their natural course. Like I said, in the form of time, he let things go on. So what happened was, the Yadavas went from the mainland of the island city of Dwarka by means of boats, and then traveled to Prabhasa in chariots. And in Prabhasa Kshetra, they drank a beverage called Maireya, and they became engaged in a mutual quarrel. So a great battle ensued, and guess what they used to kill each other? They used those sharp-edged blades, and it seemed that they were just using, you know, stalks of cane, but they were actually deadly weapons. And they killed each other. They basically carried on this pastime of their own annihilation. So, continuing in that pastime, later Lord Krishna was manifesting his form, and he sat down under a peepala tree, and he placed his left foot, which was the heel was covered in red, and he put it on top of his right thigh. And along came that same hunter, Jara, who was watching from the shore, and he mistook the Lord's red-colored foot to be the face of a deer, and he shot his arrow at it. So that is, to the mundane vision, this is how Lord Krishna was killed. So Sri Madhavacharya, in our line of disciplic succession, has written his commentary on this pastime of Lord Krishna disappearing like this. And he said, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in order to bewilder the demons and ensure that the word of his own devotees and of the brahmanas be maintained, he created a body of material energy into which the arrow was shot. But the Lord's actual form was never touched by the arrow of Jara, who was actually the Lord's devotee, Bhrigu Rishi. And then this explained how in a previous age, Bhrigu Muni had placed his foot on the chest of the Lord, of Lord Vishnu. And in order to counteract this offense, he had to take birth as a degraded hunter. But even though a great devotee willingly accepts such a low birth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself can't tolerate his own great devotee. Thus, he arranged this pastime at the end of Dwarpa Yuga, when the Lord was winding up his manifest pastimes. And so, therefore, Bhrigu Muni, in the form of the hunter, he cast this arrow into the material body, created by the Lord's illusory energy. Thus the hunter would become remorseful and gain release from his degraded birth and go back to Vaikuntha Loka. So, example of Krishna accomplishing many things at the same time. But basically, disappearance pastime was, like, says, to bewilder the materialists, and doesn't confuse the devotees. So, going back to this concept of pretension, so to me, the lesson is, don't get yourself in trouble by pretending. Sometimes I've experienced it myself that we can actually even pretend to ourselves. In other words, we may be hiding something that we may not be able to admit. Somebody was telling me the other day about a devotee who had gone regularly to a jail to see someone, and how the main lesson they got was that everybody in jail was saying, "I didn't do anything. I don't even know why I'm here. These people put me in jail, but I don't deserve to be here." Like, they're all in denial. I mean, it may be, we know there's sometimes innocent people put in jail, but the vast majority are, they're not able to admit to themselves, take responsibility for their actions. And but that ability to not admit to ourselves goes in many levels. And so it's always a good practice to examine ourselves and see what we're hiding, because there are always anarthas that are getting in our way of performing devotional service. One time when I was living in Mayapur in the 70s, I lived there in 1975-76, and I remember that some of the devotees were doing a practice of being extremely truthful, like really just only saying what was true, and even white lies. Like, there's something called white lies, like, it's not really a big deal, it's just a little pretension. We call it a white lie, but I never saw how it was all pervading in my life, because these devotees were practicing even stopping saying white lies. So I took it on for one day. And I just couldn't believe how many times during that day I found myself, it's just out of convenience or whatever the excuse is, it just was all pervading in my life. So I'm sure it's still going on. It's like, after one day, I just cannot continue with this. But still, the concept of avoiding pretension is really important. And in these last two verses that out of the four verses we read, it's described how the gopis were remembering the Lord, remembering his pastimes, and this evoked tears, and it's described they cried without shame. So in order to cry without shame, like that kind of abandoned, to abandon all your conceptions of who you, like looking good and avoiding looking bad kind of thing. Like, that would take a level of sincerity that and being real without pretension that is exemplary, and it's one of the qualities of the gopis being the most intimate devotees of Lord Krishna, most intimate, they're the lovers of Lord Krishna. I was hearing class on Saturday when Dhruva Maharaj was talking about a method of getting oneself in the right mood of chanting Hare Krishna, because that is the whole process of us becoming sincere and serious devotees of the Lord is through our chanting. And I know that unless we are chanting with extreme bliss, then there's something that's that's missing. I mean, in other words, we know that that's possible to chant in great ecstasy, and if that's not our situation, if we look at our own japa and we know that's what we're experiencing, well, we can know that that's available to us. And so we want to know how to typically, let's say we want to know how to improve our japa. Is there anybody here who's in that boat? Would you like to improve your japa? Yeah, I see many hands. Okay, I'm in the same boat too. So Dhruva Maharaj was mentioning a technique that he does and he had taught when he did a japa workshop. And he was talking about a whole meditation on sitting in a holy place, in a secluded place, and how he would make a garland and then he would offer it to Srila Prabhupada. And he was this whole meditation, which is very beautiful. I've attended many japa workshops with Satchinandan Maharaj. And the meditation that that I think about is one of he explains that there's different things that we can do, starting with the material level, to improve our japa. It's starting with using our material tongue and mouth to pronounce each word of the Maha Mantra properly, correctly, entirely. It's also like chanting every word of the Maha Mantra and sitting up straight or sitting nicely. Sometimes I personally walk, but still I can even walk with holding yourself up in nice alignment. And like those are like the material, you could say the material elements, the basis for chanting nice japa. And then the next level would be the mind, dealing with the mind, because the mind tends to wander. And whenever we notice that it's wandered, we have to pull it back and again get the mind to listen. Because Prabhupada's main instruction in chanting japa was just here. He kept on emphasizing just here. He also gave us the overall mood, which is like a child crying for his mother. But those things I've already described, properly chanting every word and pronouncing and sitting properly or walking properly and controlling the mind, those are all like the foundation. And Satchinanda Maharaj would describe like that's like you want to get into the inner sanctum of the temple, but there are several doors, several gates you have to get through. And if you do these things, then like the material elements of those elements of chanting properly, if you do it properly, then Krishna will open that first gate. And if you get the mind under control, and then you can get through the next gate. And then comes the sincerity part. And the mantra was heart deep, not lip deep. So lip deep would mean we're just mechanically saying the words, maybe out of duty or whatever our we're thinking, we're doing it just because we need to, get whatever the reason. But to take it into the heart, we're chanting from the heart, like that child crying for the mother. So that heart deep is another gate. But the final gate is one that only opens from the inside, that Lord Krishna himself can open. And that we can only do so much ourselves. And then we can sit at the gate, you could say at Krishna's lotus feet, and then just pray for Shraya, for the mercy to actually get darshan of the Lord, actual darshan. And so just wanted to share that with you. He actually had a drawing, of a Radha and Krishna in the middle, inside a temple, and then all the different gates, and we have to do our part before Krishna will do his part. Of course, he also described that if Krishna were to actually just give us darshan, and we're not prepared, if we're not actually purified, he said, you wouldn't be able to handle it. You would actually just die. That's actually what he said. But if you It's like fire will burn, but fire combined with fire, can't get any hotter than fire. So we have to prepare ourselves by chanting, following all those principles of pronouncing properly and so on, and chanting from the heart, getting the mind under control, and then actually to just be in that position of wanting to see the Lord, prepare to see the Lord. I know Srila Prabhupada was happy with George Harrison's song, My Sweet Lord, just because the mood, he said, was correct. The mood of, I want to see you, Lord. I want to be with you. And the song glorifying the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, six Goswamis of Vrindavan, that was their mood too. You know, where are you, Krishna? I want to see you. They never said, oh, I'm with Krishna. You know, look at me. It was never like that. There's always that mood of hankering, and therefore we're aspiring to chant better japa. We're aspiring to be a sincere, serious follower of Srila Prabhupada. Also, one more thought about pretension is that one of my services is I compile the Srila Prabhupada disciple database. And because of that service, I have come across some people who you could say are pretending to have taken diksha from Srila Prabhupada. So I come across that regularly, and I just feel like I want to say something about we are all followers of Srila Prabhupada, and that is the important identification. It's not really like in our daily activities. Are we so concerned about who it is who actually gave us diksha? Or is it the fact that we are following Srila Prabhupada because he is the shiksha guru of everyone in ISKCON, or everyone who accepts being a follower of Srila Prabhupada? When I was in Mayapur for the Gaur Praneem Festival this year, a wonderful book came out called Srila Prabhupada, Our Founder Acharya, or The Founder Acharya of ISKCON. And I wish I could have brought back more copies I brought back, I distributed, but it is available online. I know that my husband has like the link on every one of his emails, but right now I can't think of that exact link, but dandavats.com, I believe, has a copy of that, so it is available online. And that book is extremely important in explaining Srila Prabhupada's position. And it starts at the very first line saying that Srila Prabhupada had a very particular way he wanted his name printed in all of his books. He wanted to say His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, and he wanted his title, which is Founder Acharya. It's a hyphenated combination of Sanskrit and English. Founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He was very, very particular about that. And in the book, it actually describes, how that evolved. Because, in the very early days, we didn't even call Srila Prabhupada. Devotees called Prabhupada Swamiji. And after some time, Govindadasi had asked Srila Prabhupada about that particular title. And he said it wasn't first class. She said, well, why are we calling you that? What else can we call you? And then he said, you can call me Prabhupada. And, so it wasn't at the very early days. So in the early publications, his name was expressed in different ways. So in that book, which Rabindra Sarup wrote it, but it was really a whole committee of like about 20 or 25 devotees who have been working on establishing Srila Prabhupada's position. They call it Srila Prabhupada Position Committee. It's under the GBC. They form this committee. And they have presented so much detail that I'm just recommending that everybody read it, because when I read it, I felt like, you know, every devotee in ISKCON should really thoroughly understand Srila Prabhupada's position. And so I just want to end with, again, appreciating the devotees here in Alachua, and the I wanted to ask for everyone's blessings. And it just so happened that I was assigned this day to give class, and it just so happens to be my son's 4th wedding anniversary. And I would ask everyone to give blessings to Rasacharya Das and his wife Sachi. They just drove across America from New York to California, and they're arriving in LA today, starting a new phase of their lives. He's accepted at a graduate school called American Film Institute. And I just ask for your blessings that he's able to use his career in cinematography and use it in a Krishna conscious way. If anybody wants to see the video that he just made when he completed his undergraduate degree, it's just a 9-minute video that he made, but he has a little spiritual twist to it. And if you want to see it, I can send you the link. You just have to let me know. Okay? Thank you very much. All bless you. Bye-bye. Questions and comments and corrections. Okay, we'll start with Mahatma Dasi.
I just wanted to be sure, because I was confused myself. I just asked Mother Radharnika. That book that you mentioned, The Founder Acharya, yeah, actually has to be the bona fide, because there is another one that the Read Big Group people or group have published. So I don't know what is the difference or whatever, but I just want to be sure that the one you're mentioning is published by BBT or...
Yes, it's they call it a GBC document. Yeah. As they say, look for the BBT logo. Okay, Guru Prasad.
These examples of abandonment that you just read,
yeah,
you know, it applies to the material world, and I have the feeling, I mean, maybe I'm off, that when the gopis were saying it, they were saying, this is what will happen, in, you know, normally, but yeah, because we love Krishna so much, even though he has abandoned us, we have no, you know, we're not going to abandon. So after I read all those, when I read it in Krishna book too, I always said, yes, this is what will happen in the material world, you know, this is a situation. But, you know, they love Krishna so much that they said, okay, this is what would happen in the material, but we are not doing that. We will, you know, this is their mood before they spoke to Uddhava. So I always get the feeling this is such a deep, deep, deep love that, you know, I mean, yes, it's hard to not, you know, abandon this situation if it's like this and this, but we're not going to do that.
Okay, that's a nice way of seeing it. Thank you. Yeah, but Prabhupada does say those words that they were indirectly accusing him of abandoning them. So, but yeah, it's nice. Somebody over here had their hand up? No? Okay, thank you very much. Yeah. Okay,